From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Ramadan, the ninth month of the Islamic calendar observed by Muslims worldwide, began this week. It's a month of fasting, prayer, and reflection.
So the Islamic rule of fasting during the month of Ramadan is to abstain from water, food, extra vices that are normally throughout your given day, and to think about what it means to not have them from the sun up to sundown.
Cameron Gill is the sous chef at Pija Palace in Silver Lake. He shares what it's like to observe Ramadan in a kitchen when your job is to taste.
Hi, my name is Cameron Gill. I'm the sous chef at an Indian-Italian fusion restaurant called Pija Palace, and I am one of the second in charge of this very busy restaurant. I first started fasting for Ramadan fully when I think I was in fifth or sixth grade. It's kind of hard to remember when it all blends together, because I did kids fasts where I'd only fast for half of the day, and then at some point it just transitioned and my memory is, oh yeah, it's time for Ramadan and doing it. But I want to confidently say I started in middle school time. I had to explain Ramadan to a lot of people throughout my life because I went to Catholic school from first to eighth grade, and I lived in Northern Virginia. At the time, there wasn't a ton of Muslim people in that community that I was in. There are a ton in Virginia, but just where I was educated and some of the friends I hung out around weren't familiar with the faith. So through my schooling and through talking with my friend's parents who didn't really know it, it was explaining why I'm not eating after school or why I'm not eating at lunch and what's going on and what it really means to be in that month of Ramadan. In 2001 in Virginia, I was in first grade in Alexandria, very close to the Pentagon. My entire school was a lot of military people that were working at the Pentagon at the time. So during the attacks at that time, it was very scary. But in Virginia, it was a very tough time to be Muslim. So anything that kind of gave way to people seeing that you were part of the faith got you looks. Some people were a little more blatant about it, and you'd hear comments. And my dad actually ran for political office out there, and I was helping him door knock and, you know, pass out pamphlets. And I've had people call me a terrorist and cock a shotgun at me and tell me to get off their property. So it wasn't the easiest time, but it was still nice to have the community where we all got together during Ramadan and feasted and talked about what was happening. And if anyone was stressed, there'd be that togetherness that was so difficult to find when growing up in that area. A common misconception with fasting is that I don't eat anything for 30 days, but that's not true. Every night is like a celebration of you break your fast at night, and that's iftar, where once you're done, the sun is finally down, you get to enjoy some food, some water, finally. My family had two restaurants in Virginia. A couple days out of Ramadan, we'd always go and have a big family party at the restaurant, or we'd take over the little banquet area. Everyone would come dressed up. You'd have all the kids you haven't seen, the cousins, and then there'd just be a full buffet line of all the delicious food that we grew up eating. And it was such a precious and amazing experience to just sit there with my cousins. You know, you get all your kids together and just have a kids' table where you're playing and eating, and then there'll be prayers after we finish. And it was a very special time. So as a sous chef, my responsibilities are quality control of everything that is being prepped in the kitchen, keeping people on task, and managing the overall flow of the restaurant alongside chef and the other sous. Anything that gets prepped in the day has to get tasted so we know that it's good for service. and anything that is being made for dinner service, which is normally where I operate, any plate that goes out into our 5-hour service gets tasted. But during Ramadan, I'm unable to do either of those tastings. So I carry around a pocket full of spoons and I'll hand it to the head chef, or I'll hand it to them, or I have to put a lot of trust into my cooks and my prep team that they know how to do it. And if they think something needs to be adjusted, then I'll trust them and say that, okay, let's add some more salt, let's add some lime, because unfortunately I can't do it. I wish I could, because I want everything to be great and everything to taste good, but it's something for me to think about and appreciate when I can't actually taste it again. Depending on the year, luckily this year it's going to not be as late in the night when I can break the fast, but I will break my fast in the middle of service, so I can start tasting food again afterwards. I'll take a small moment of respite to say a little prayer, eat, and then get some water, and then hop back in, and finally I can make adjustments after I've broken my fast. But the lack of water in a kitchen is, to me, the most difficult aspect of fasting. You notice it a lot near the end of the fast. In the beginning, it's not too bad because you haven't been running around yet. It's a little bit slower. But once dinner really starts picking up and you're running around, you're carrying plates, you're putting things away, it starts to tax you a little bit. Like, you can feel yourself get like a little bit of a headache sometimes if you didn't prepare properly. It starts to drain your energy a little bit. Traditionally, everyone breaks their fast with dates because that's what the prophet did. So it's like good and good graces for you to do the same. I personally don't like dates, so I don't really eat them. But during the month of Ramadan, no matter what, I will break my fast with a date. It's just the way that I grew up. My dad would hand me a date and say, all right, time to break the fast, let's do it. So it's just tradition to me at this point. Like, it doesn't feel right without it. I would like to have a iftar dinner at Pija Palace with members of the community, the staff, and do something special just to kind of, again, recreate that sense of community that I had growing up in Virginia with my family and with the mosques and everything. So I would like to do, for the final iftar at Ramadan, I'd like to do something at Pija Palace. It's like a little special nod to the end of the month.
That was Cameron Gill. He's a sous chef at Pija Palace, the popular Indian sports bar in Silver Lake. He's been sharing how he's observing Ramadan as a chef, fasting from sunrise to sunset during the holy month. Coming up, gluten-free pie, gluten-free egg noodles, gluten-free sourdough. Not only is it possible, it can be delicious too. My next guest is a recipe developer who's cracked the code on how to eat and enjoy a gluten-free life.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Good Food. You know, we humans are programmed to want to eat food. It's how we survive. But for most of us, food is about more than survival. It's about pleasure and community, entertainment and travel. So receiving a celiac diagnosis can be devastating. One must embark on learning a new culinary language, and one that can often seem less than. Laura Strange is here to tell us that that's not necessarily so. She's a Londoner who develops recipes and travel guides for those of us who need to traverse a gluten-free world. Hi, Laura.
Hello. What a lovely introduction.
Well, thank you for coming to spend some time with us.
My pleasure.
How old were you when you were diagnosed with celiac disease?
So I was 14 when I was diagnosed with celiac disease, but it must have been about age 7 when I started having symptoms. Like many people, unfortunately, it took quite a while for me to get that diagnosis. And in the meantime, I got so poorly. I lost a huge amount of weight, really struggled to get through the day, especially, you know, when you're a child and you're at school, lots of energy is needed and you really don't have that when you're an undiagnosed celiac. And then luckily, one day we happened to see a different doctor and she immediately recognized my symptoms as being very typical of celiac disease, got me diagnosed, and it was like a whole new lease of life. And while having celiac disease can be so hard to live with, for me, getting that diagnosis was one of the best things that has ever happened to me, because it enabled me to then get healthy and strong and really live a wonderful life again.
So at the time of your diagnosis, you were still living at home, and I imagine that your meals mm-hmm. were still being planned and prepared by a parent. So you had to embark on this new world as a family. Did you have a memorable set of disaster substitutions that made you kind of despair of your situation?
Absolutely. I remember you couldn't get gluten-free products so readily then. This was 25 years ago. So while now there's a really good availability of gluten-free products, back then they were hard to source. Some you had to get from pharmacists, some from the back shelf of health food shops. And I remember we bought some vegetable pasta. And as you are, busy at home, we hadn't quite observed the cooking instructions. So cooked the pasta for a little bit too long, went into the saucepan to stir the pasta, and it had disappeared. All that was left was a sludge at the bottom of the pan. Because they were vegetable based, it completely disintegrated. And so that was very memorable. And the early gluten-free bread as well, some of it was atrocious. It would either crumble apart like sand or be so brick-like that there was a risk you could probably knock someone out if you threw it. I would not recommend doing that.
You know, many people think that the biggest challenge in cooking gluten-free meals are those that focus on breads, baked cakes, cookies mm-hmm. and pies, noodles of all kinds, and foods that are enrobed in batters, like many UK staples are, like battered fish and chips. Mm-hmm. You've been cooking this way for a long time. Has your approach to creating recipes changed due to the evolution of ingredients that are available?
Oh, absolutely. There's such a wonderful wide range of gluten-free ingredients now. There's a better understanding of gluten-free products as well by some chefs. So, for example, some professionals who I know now make their gluten fish and chips with gluten-free flour as standard because it happens to make a better batter. So that's really encouraging to see some recognition of gluten-free foods not always being second class or subpar.
I imagine that you must spend a lot of time educating other people about what you can and can't eat. What do people misunderstand about celiac?
So I think there are quite a few common misconceptions. Celiac disease, it's not an allergy, it's an autoimmune condition. So a genetic condition that can run in families. So my mother also has celiac disease. And unfortunately, once you have it, you cannot grow out of it. You are celiac for life. And you have to stick to a really strict gluten-free diet. While there's lots of gluten-free food options available, sometimes they might not be safe for celiacs because of cross-contact. Cross-contact occurs when you've got a gluten-containing food item touches your gluten-free one, therefore making it no longer safe for celiacs. So that's not always widely known, that if you're preparing food for celiacs, you have to be really mindful of how you're preparing things, be really hygienic and safe about how you're cooking, because even the smallest amount of gluten can make celiacs really poorly.
Why does wheat-free not necessarily mean gluten-free?
That's a great question. So you find gluten not just in wheat, but also in barley and rye and oats, unless they are specially milled as safely gluten-free. While oats contain a protein called avenin, which is similar to gluten, they are gluten-free until the milling process. They're often processed in the same location as wheat, barley and rye, hence the issue with cross-contamination. So If you are looking for gluten-free products, you need to make sure that there's no wheat, barley, rye, or oats on the labels.
You say in the beginning part of the book that a first step is to embrace naturally gluten-free foods. Give us some examples.
Well, I think that's it, isn't there? So many naturally gluten-free foods that people will be eating all the time. Staples such as rice, potatoes, vegetables and meat. There are so many different gluten-free foods that you can easily incorporate into a diet. And it can make it more economical to be shopping outside of your sort of dedicated gluten-free food section. And then the meals also become ones that you can share with the entire family. If you're making a rice-based dish like a paella or jambalaya, then that's something that you can share as a household rather than having to prepare multiple different meals.
There are magic ingredients on which you rely. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of them.
So xanthan gum is one. It's a binder that works fantastically in cakes and pasta and pastry as well. You only use it in tiny quantities. And when you're taking gluten out of a recipe, you're losing that binding quality that the gluten protein gives. So by introducing another binder such as xanthan gum, you're able to ensure that you don't have a crumbly dry cake, but a lovely fluffy sponge instead. Another favourite of mine is psyllium husk, which is a naturally derived seed husk. And this is just incredible for making gluten-free breads. It gives you a bread dough that holds a high hydration, and then you can subsequently shape it and knead it, make beautiful bakes like cinnamon buns and sourdough balls, and have a wonderful baking time in the kitchen. And a third one I'd love to mention is tapioca starch as well, which is a naturally gluten-free starch, which is derived from cassava. Adding that into breads as well brings a stretchy property, and it just makes a lovely addition to pizza bases and lots of the breads that I've featured in my book.
What is your easiest recipe for a bread of any kind from your new book? It can be a flatbread.
Yeah, so, well, that's exactly the one I was thinking of. So I've got a whole chapter on breads in the book. And the first one in the chapter is a really easy flatbread recipe, which is one we also make a lot at home. It's made simply using all-purpose gluten-free flour, baking powder, and yogurt. And you can make it in 15 minutes. It's ideal when you need like a bread side dish to go with dinner and you just want to whip something up. You haven't got time to run to the grocery store. You haven't got time to make a yeasted bread. This flatbread is a great one to go to. And it's also a wonderful place to start if you're wanting to get your confidence with baking gluten-free bread. And that's something I've really done throughout my cookbook with all the chapters, starting with nice, easy recipes to ease everyone into gluten-free baking or cooking, and then building up your skill level as you work your way through each chapter so you can become an expert before you know it.
So here at KCRW, Good Food hosts an annual pie contest that last year drew 500 pies and 10,000 people at the event.
Wow.
So pie dough is a particular obsession. How do you deal with it as coming from a pie eating and making culture? Is it possible to make the famed British hot water dough gluten-free, or did you have to go in another direction?
Yes, do you know, I hadn't actually tackled the hot water dough here. So that would often be used for making British pork pies and similar. I'll have to add that to my to-do list. But I do have a beautiful short crust pastry in the book, which is really versatile and can be used for sweet and savoury bakes. So I've got a lovely chicken and wild garlic pie recipe in the book as well. On the sweeter side, we've got a passion fruit meringue pie. It's a real tried and tested recipe that's on my website long before I added it to the book. And I have had so much lovely feedback from people over the years who had thought, oh gosh, I can't make gluten-free pastry. It's going to turn out horribly. And then they try this recipe, find it nice and easily, end up with a beautiful pie crust. And it's, you know, it really opens a whole new world of baking to you, and hopefully it would fare well in your pie competition.
I'm sure it would. You said that you were particularly proud of cracking the code to making egg noodles. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. Oh, that was a lovely one. It wasn't as hard as I thought it would be. It was, I think, the beauty of sitting down to write a gluten-free cookbook. I really just decided, okay, these are all the foods that I miss having. I just want to tackle all these recipes. And the egg noodle recipe that I came to, they're just wonderful. My husband can eat gluten, as can my children. So they're really good taste testers when I create a new recipe. And when I developed the egg noodles, my husband was just blown away. He said he could not tell the difference between the classic wheat egg noodles and the gluten-free ones that I've created in the book. They hold together beautifully. They can be stir-fried in a chow mein or other stir-fry dishes. And I think being able to create a noodle that behaves as you would like it to in the traditional dishes was a lovely achievement.
What is your, I'm so exhausted, but I still have to go make something for dinner dish?
I have a long-term favorite, and it's in the book. It's a 15-minute peanut butter tahini noodles dish, and it's properly 15 minutes from start of it being on your plate. And it's really versatile as well, family-friendly. My whole family will happily eat it. Actually, the base dish is vegan. Then you can add in the protein of your choice, whether it's tofu or whether you want to add chicken, prawns, or just keep it simple. But that is the one. I think we all need one of those in our repertoires, don't we? When we have had a busy day at work and you need to feed the family and you just want to sit down, but you also want to have a good plate full of food. That is my go-to recipe.
What is your most requested sweet bake from friends and family?
Oh, there's a clear winner here. I have a salted caramel brownie recipe in the cookbook, and it's almost become an accidental signature bake with my friends and family. My friends are always requesting that I bring the brownies with me, and I'm always glad to because they're really easy. I can make them the night before. They just happily sit however long. And I rate these brownies so much that when I got married 8 years ago, I actually made my wedding cake out of them. We made this, my bridesmaids and I made this gigantic tower of gluten-free brownies because we could bake them a couple of days before and decorate them very beautifully. And I didn't tell anyone that it was all gluten-free. And the best thing was that by the end of the wedding, everything, all the brownies had been eaten. There were literally only crumbs remaining. And it was really nice seeing everyone enjoy something that I knew was gluten-free.
I love that. This has been such a great conversation. Thank you, Laura.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you again for having me. It's been lovely speaking to you.
That was gluten-free expert Laura Strange. Her book is Eat and Enjoy Gluten-Free. Head to kcrw.com/goodfood for two of Laura's recipes, her 15-minute peanut butter and tahini noodles, and those salted caramel brownies she talked about. Well, folks, are you ready to bake your heart out? KCRW's Good Food Pie Fest and Contest is back. Once again, we're partnering with the Fowler Museum for a pie-filled afternoon with baking demos, music, a marketplace with food vendors, a beer garden, kids' activities, an apron fashion show, and did I mention pie? Bakers from around the Southland will compete in 9 categories in Good Food's 12th annual pie contest. Everyone is going to be vying for that coveted Best in Show ribbon. So come cheer on the bakers and enjoy the activities on Royce Quad at UCLA on Sunday, April 28th. Bakers, if you're interested in entering a pie in this year's contest, registration is now open. We have some big changes to this year's categories, so listen up. We're going all in on fruit and nut pies this year, which means we've expanded the fruit categories to add double crust apple pie, apple crumble pie, and berry pie. We've also added a hand pie category, which the crust lover in me is very much looking forward to. Other categories include nut pie, vegan pie, lineage pie inspired by the Fowler Museum, plus we have a 12 and under category for all of you young chefs. This year, we are saying goodbye to the savory, custard, and cream pie categories. That means no meat, no dairy. I'm sure some of you will have questions, so go to kcrw.com/pie and check out the Baker FAQ to find all the answers. I cannot wait to see you at UCLA on April 28th. In a minute, remember when California banned plastic bags? Well, it turns out there was a loophole in the law, and plastic bag use has actually increased since the ban was passed. Find out why and what legislators are doing about it next.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. A decade ago in 2014, the California legislature passed a statewide ban on single-use plastic bags. Many other states and municipalities passed similar bans. Now we all bring reusable sacks to the grocery store, and plastic bag use has declined, and everything is hunky-dory, right? Well, not exactly. In fact, instead of seeing a reduction in plastic bag waste, material recovery facilities have noticed the opposite trend. If you measure by weight, plastic bag waste has increased to unprecedented levels. What's going on? We decided to ask Suzanne Rust, who has covered this issue for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Suzanne.
Hey, nice to talk to you.
Yeah, this is one of those stories that just makes my brain just want to pop out of my skull. Makes me so angry. Why don't you start off by giving us the cold, hard statistics on plastic bag use in 2014 versus 2022? What are the numbers and where do they come from?
All right. So if you go back to 2014, if you were to look at how much people used, so tons per 1,000 people, for instance, people were using about 4.08 tons of plastic bags per 1,000 people. So that's how much would go into the garbage every year. By 2022, that number had increased to 5.89. I mean, just to give you sort of another number there, by 2022, as you've already noted, this plastic bag waste weight had increased 47% from 2018. So that's a lot.
So what's the culprit behind this increase in plastic bag waste?
So when the law was written, the idea was we'd get rid of those plastic bags that you get when you go to the grocery store, to Target, or someplace like that. You know, they would just automatically hand you when you were done with the cashier, and they might double it, right? Because plastic bag waste was everywhere and everybody was seeing it. So the idea was, let's get rid of that. But they knew people would go into grocery stores and maybe forget a bag, not be able to carry the stuff out. So they wanted to give people options. And so, of course, they decided paper bags would be a good option. And then in a weird little loophole, which was sort of a nod to two very small California plastic manufacturing companies, they said, all right, we'll also let you provide for 10 cents a plastic bag, but it has to be something that's reusable. So these companies said, ah, we've got that. It's made out of this kind of plastic called HDPE. And we've done studies and it looks like it can be used 125 times. So lawmakers said, all right, that will be an option for people when they are at the end of the groceries line. If they didn't bring their bags, they can have this kind of plastic. And initially, because there were only two companies, they were very small, that really wasn't an issue. Fast forward until 2020, and we have COVID. And suddenly everybody's terrified, right? You can't even bring your own bag to the grocery store. They won't put anything in it for fear of germs. Plastic goes bananas, right? There's suddenly plastic everywhere. And like, yeah, using the word bananas, there's suddenly plastic around bananas. But people started getting those plastic bags, and plastic bag manufacturers saw that there was this loophole in the law. And so they started creating more of these plastic bags, and they bought out those two little California companies, and production increased. And suddenly, a year later, 2 years later, that's the kind of plastic people buy when they get off of the grocery store line. And the behavior that had changed before 2020, like, disappeared. And now, because people are buying plastic bags when they get to the end of the cashier, because their behavior changed as a result of COVID, and because those bags are actually heavier than the first ones, you get this increase in the weight of plastic bag waste.
Okay, so are these bags actually recyclable? When I get them, always feeling extremely guilty that I didn't have my home bag that I brought with me, because I have 100 of those. I will sometimes use them as a garbage bag. And so they'll get used twice in my household, for example. So this idea of 125 times seems like insane. And then, can they be recycled?
So if you talk to plastic bag manufacturers, they'll tell you they can be recycled. But anybody who's followed the whole plastic bag saga will tell you, no, for the most part, these bags are not being recycled. They're being put into landfill or blowing into the river or blowing into the ocean. And they never claimed, as I recall, I could be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure they weren't given this exemption because they could be recycled. They were given this exemption because they were reusable.
So what are California legislators doing about this particular conundrum, if anything?
Yes. Yeah, so a week or two ago, lawmakers, they came in with a law that will address this loophole. No longer will you be able to buy for 10 cents one of those plastic bags when you go through the grocery line. Those are no longer allowed. The language hadn't been written by the time the story was written, and I think they're still working on the language. But my understanding of what the law will look like, the issue will be recyclability. The reusable thing is not a term that will be used anymore. It's recyclable. So it will have to be some sort of material like paper. Maybe you could get a cardboard box, something that can be recycled, put it back into the waste stream and turned into a new product.
And when do you think it'll be through the legislative process and we'll actually see the change?
So I've heard differing things. The first thing I heard was this is probably not going to be a big deal. It'll pass through without much opposition because the grocery manufacturers are fully behind this, which makes passage easier if industry is behind it. But I've been told subsequently that, you know, the plastics industry is probably going to push back on this. Having said that, California is pretty progressive when it comes to plastics legislation, and I imagine this won't have too much resistance and would probably see something within the next year.
So this also speaks to the larger, thornier issue of plastics recycling. We've seen several stories in the past few years that essentially say the same thing. Plastics recycling is a sham that was concocted by the plastic industry to convince consumers to keep buying plastic with a clear conscience. How recyclable are most of the single-use plastic products we bring into our homes?
So it varies. Some products like soda bottles, particularly if they are clear, those can be recycled. And there are actually recycling facilities within California along the West Coast. They'll break those down and make new bottles. But again, clear is the key there. If you start adding color, the resulting plastic that's manufactured is sort of this weird gray and nobody really likes to use it. For other products, it really does not look good. Polypropylene that's the number 5 that you see. As far as I can tell, and people I have spoken to say there is no polypropylene recycling facility anywhere west of the Mississippi. And of course, it wouldn't make much sense if you're concerned about the environment to truck it all the way to the East Coast to have it there. So lots of this stuff ends up getting shipped. It might go across the border to Mexico. It might get shipped across the seas to places like the Pacific Ocean, to a place like Malaysia or Vietnam. But it's not recycled. And then there's the question of the number two plastics, the HDPEs, the things you put your dish soap liquid in or your laundry liquid in. Pretty low recycling rates on those as well. I think in 2019, the US EPA said something like only 8 or 9% of all plastic, all these single-use plastics that we use, get recycled. And, you know, just on a sort of another note, I was reading in The Guardian this morning that researchers who looked at placentas, every human placenta that they tested had microplastics in it. I mean, we're swimming in plastic.
Oh, let's go outside and look at the sun and try and find some joy.
Sometimes does feel like it, doesn't it? Until you start thinking about the dust you're breathing in. Microplastics.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me, and sorry to put a damper on your day there.
That was reporter Suzanne Rust discussing the failure of California's 2014 plastic bag ban. For a link to her Los Angeles Times story, head to our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. What does it mean to have a feminist restaurant? In her book, Ingredients for a Revolution, A History of American Feminist Restaurants, Cafes, and Coffee Houses, Alex Ketchum offers us a definition. Hi, Alex.
Hi, it's so nice to talk with you.
Oh, it's great to have you here. Maybe you could start by explaining feminist restaurants to us. What is a feminist restaurant?
In the most simple definition, feminist restaurants are restaurants that call themselves feminist, either in their title or in their advertising, publications, events that they held. But what this really meant for me was a restaurant that tried to embody its own feminist values in either its menu, in its labor choices, in its aesthetics, and its production of events.
Your book starts with restaurants in 1972, but was there a history of feminist restaurants in the U.S. before then?
For sure. So the reason I start the book at 1972 is because that's when the first feminist restaurant, Mother Courage, began. And this was a feminist restaurant that was really interested in creating space for feminists, for activists, for women and the women's movement. Now, there were restaurants earlier. And there's this great book called Selling Suffrage by Margaret Finnegan that talks about this, which were restaurants started by feminists that tried to lure men into them so they could give them brochures about why women should have suffrage, the right to vote. So they had cheap food, but the table would be covered in brochures and information. And when men ate that lunch, they would hear information about suffrage. So the reason I made the book about the ones from 1972 onward was because I was interested in restaurants that were trying to create feminist space for feminists and other people interested in these ideas.
What role did they play in the politics and culture of women of the time?
They were really useful for creating a space where people could congregate, share political ideas, form community. There were spaces where women artists could display their work on the walls, where feminist poets could perform, where activists could talk about their ideas. Many of them also functioned as feminist bookstores, so they were part of the women in print movement and the showing and showcasing of feminist ideas in written publications, books, brochures, and so forth. And they also created space where women, and particularly lesbians and women who today might identify as queer women, could work out in their identity so they didn't have to be closeted at work. They could be a space where women plumbers and architects and real estate agents and tradespeople could actually be valued for their labor and would oftentimes be hired. So they created economic opportunities. And they also created a space where people could connect to the land, to food, to politics and community.
You know, it's so interesting to me. A lot of people don't realize that in the 1970s, women still didn't have the most basic access to capital, most women. So who financed some of these early feminist hospitality outlets?
For sure. That's a great question. Now, prior to 1974, which was when the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, or the ECOA, was passed in the United States, women weren't guaranteed credit in their own name. So it was perfectly legal for a bank to deny women credit, and she wouldn't need it to be co-signed with either a husband or father. Since many of these spaces were founded by women, and particularly lesbians, who are already facing sexism because of being women, and also heterosexism, traditional bank financing wasn't even possible for many of the people who created feminist restaurants, even after the passage of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. And we also all know that even because a law is passed, that doesn't mean that people still don't discriminate. So many of these restaurants relied on strategies that today we might call crowdfunding. They would host dances, other fundraising events. They would have sometimes those kinds of pop-up events. They work county fairs. They would also try to secure financing from people in their community. So they would ask for people to give donations. They would ask people to invest in the space. Many people poured a lot of their own savings into the restaurant. And many of them did try to diversify some of their ways of raising capital, such as a Bloodroot Feminist Vegetarian Restaurant, which was founded in 1977, that also functioned as a bookstore. And that's actually the oldest feminist restaurant that is continuously in operation. So they're still around today.
Yeah, tell us a little more about Bloodroot Feminist Vegetarian Restaurant of Bridgeport, Connecticut. That's a mouthful.
Yeah, so Bloodroot is actually the reason I first started doing this research. I was an undergrad at Wesleyan University. I was really involved with the school's organic farm long lane. I started a food politics house called Farmhouse, and I was doing feminist studies and taking a lot of history courses. And I was thinking about what I was going to do my undergraduate honors thesis on, and I was thinking about how could I bring together my interest in food politics and feminism and history. And I had a friend mention, oh, have you ever been to Bloodroot? It's just down the road, which was Bridgeport, Connecticut. So about a 45-minute drive. And I visited with a few friends, and I was instantly just so fascinated. Bloodroot was founded by Selma Miriam as part of the Bloodroot Collective. She continues to operate it today. She's in her 80s now with Noel Fury, who joined the collective very early on within the first year. And it's a space that, like I mentioned, is a small bookstore on one side. It's near the Long Island Sound. It's part of the Black Rock community. And it has photos on the walls of women, from customers who have brought them in, from garage sales. It's kind of mixed match furniture. Everything is vegetarian. Most of it's vegan. They've produced a series of cookbooks, starting from their first one, The Political Palette, in the 1980s. And they really think intently about what it means to think about the environment and feminism and community and labor practices.
Although some of the restaurants that you mentioned in your book had a distinct anti-capitalist bent, not all of them did. Some were cooperatives, some were nonprofits, and some were for-profit enterprises. Can a restaurant still be a feminist space if it's operating as a for-profit entity?
So that's a big question, right? The relationship between feminism and capitalism. And this is an ongoing challenge for feminist eateries such as Lagusta Yearwood's multiple businesses. So Lagusta Yearwood is a feminist vegan anarchist chocolate maker who has a few businesses in New York State, in New Paltz and New York City. And she talks all the time about the challenges that she faces. Trying to function in a capitalist society while trying to make sure that her workers have proper health care, that she can pay people properly, that she can pay the farmers properly, that she can make sure that she's taking care of the people in her community. But no one founded these spaces in order to make a lot of money. The real goal with them was to create community centers, to create a space where people could gather and share food and ideas and nourish their hearts and their minds and their bellies. And they were not really out there to make a lot of money. But of course, when you're in a capitalist system, you still have to pay the rent. You have to pay for your ingredients, your supplies. You need to make sure that your workers are properly compensated. And when collectives were trying to manage those challenges of making sure that they could buy good quality ingredients, make sure that their prices weren't too high because many of their customers didn't have a lot of money, as women are paid less, especially lesbians were paid even less. It basically meant that many of the collectives had burnout. The people who started these spaces weren't making enough money to survive. So capitalism is an ongoing challenge for feminism.
How many feminist restaurants do you think there are in the U.S. circa now, 2023?
Oh, okay. I would say that if I'm using the specific definition that I did for the project, which is that they have to use feminist in their title, there's around, I'd say, probably two dozen ones if you're including the bookstores that also sell coffee and food. So it's a lot lower than we saw in the 1970s and 1980s. But I do want to make clear that there are a lot of spaces that embody feminist values, but they're not necessarily using the term. So you have social justice restaurants and you have anarchist restaurants, right? But this project was really interested in what are the stakes in calling it a feminist restaurant or a feminist cafe. And so we actually see the rise of a lot more explicitly feminist restaurants around 2015, 2016, due to the political situation in the United States and the kind of rise of Donald Trump's move towards being the president. And so a lot of people thought this is a really important time to explicitly use the word feminist. And that's when you start to see a bunch more of these spaces pop up.
So interesting. Well, thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a real pleasure.
That was Alex Ketchum, who teaches gender and feminist studies at McGill University in Quebec. She's also the author of Ingredients for Revolution, a history of American feminist restaurants, cafes, and coffee houses. Head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood, for more info. Daylight savings is behind us and spring has arrived at the farmer's market. Find out what's in season next. I'm Evan Kleiman and this is Good Food. Spring is springing at the farmer's market. Let's check in with Jillian Ferguson to see what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. The spring equinox is on Tuesday, and right on cue, the market is alive with signs of spring. I'm here today with Alicia Kemper, who, along with her business partner Marie, is the owner of Mangette, a French cafe in Long Beach serving market-inspired food. Hi, Alicia.
Hi there.
So what are you shopping for today?
Today we are shopping for sugar snap peas are the main thing, but we get all of our produce at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. So anything, any produce driven items that we have on the menu, we get here.
So let's talk about those snap peas. How are you using them?
So we're making a soup out of them. so we're doing a puree with them, straining it to get out all of the little stringy bits. But we still want to be able to have people like taste the actual sugar snap peas. So we're doing a little salad tossed in whey, which is a byproduct that we use from a yogurt that we make in-house as well. So we make a whey vinaigrette. So you get like some of the crunch from the sugar snap peas and then the pure essence of it in a puree form.
So many people use sugar snaps for salads. I've never heard it being used for a soup before. What was the inspiration?
We just really enjoy the expression of the sugar snap peas. It's just so delicate and pure and has like such a lovely flavor that we really wanted to capture that. Most people use like frozen peas for their soup, so we wanted to just do a pure sugar snap pea puree. That's a mouthful. And it was a little thin when we tested it out, so we thought potatoes would add a nice like roundness and texture to it. So we just use a little bit of potato puree from Weiser to give it some roundness. And then because everyone's so familiar with the crunch, we leave those on top so people can still enjoy that aspect as well.
What's the difference in flavor between a cooked sugar snap and a raw sugar snap?
I think because we cook it so quickly that you get a lot of the similar flavors. You get that like sweetness, the delicateness. We infuse a little bit of mint in the broth or in the liquid that we're using, so it's just like a very subtle, like sweet and delicate flavor, which is I think different.
Is it served warm?
It's served like lukewarm, so not cold, not hot, just a nice warm temperature to not overpower anything. And coming with the warmer weather, it's nice.
Does the menu change all the time at Manjet? Are you changing the menu daily?
No, we change it seasonally. We have a very small team, so we we don't have the bandwidth to change it every single day. But things change definitely based on what we can get at the market. Like I said, we get all of our produce either on Wednesday or on Sundays if we run out. There's a Long Beach Farmers Market on Sundays that we love. So we have to figure out, and if we run out of salad, we run out of salad, which has definitely happened.
Alicia, you also own the wine store next door called Bouvon. Do the two storefronts ever collaborate?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, this Saturday, we're going to have a pop-up of Manjet out the back door. So we're going to be selling lobster rolls done on a brioche bun that's toasted with a little bit of butter, chives that we get at the market, and fresh lemon from the market as well. And then we have a fish fillet sandwich, which we use Little Jim lettuce from Coleman Farms, and then lots of herbs also from the market in our remoulade.
That sounds awesome. And that's at Bouvon or at Manjet?
So the pop-up is at Bouvon, but we're using the food of Manjet. They're in the same building, just side by side, and we share a backyard. So it's fun if you ever want to come drink wine in the afternoon starting at noon. We open up the wine shop, and you can enjoy food from Manjet and wine from Bouvon.
How wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Alicia Kemper, co-owner of Manjet, along with her business partner, Marie Delberry. The chef there is Noe Duran. The cafe is right next to Bouvon, Alicia's wine store, on Loma Avenue in Long Beach. Zach Nichols is the farmer behind Two Peas in a Pod, where Alicia is buying her snap peas. And Zach, it's been a long time since we talked. Tell us what's going on at the farm.
So we are in transition period. We are coming out of the winter crop, which is all brassicas, cruciferous, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, broccolini. And we are moving on into the spring. And the farm is actually called Two Peas in a Pod. And the reason for that is because we are, or were, the first people to actually grow sugar snap peas. My father was a Cal Poly graduate, and he worked for a seed company before he started the farm. And there was a doctor who would send them seeds, and he actually sent some sugar snap seeds to him. And we had no idea what to do with them, and we didn't know how to grow them, etc. So we kind of played around with it. And that is the reason why we got into farmers markets, is because we started planting so much that we needed to figure out a way to sell them. So long story short, my mom would go to farmers market and no one knew what they were. And she would have a plate with ranch dressing, and she would dip the peas in ranch dressing and hand them to people. And the crop got so big that obviously nowadays it's everywhere here in California.
One of the things that blows my mind about snap peas is that it's a relatively new plant. I think it was introduced by Calvin Lamborn in the 80s, right?
Yep. So that was actually Dr. Lamborn.
Yeah.
So I had to clarify this with my mother. I just called her actually to make sure that was his name. He was the guy who gave my dad the seed. And like I said, seeds take a long, long, long time to breed. There's no way to speed up the maturation process or the process to flowering. So you kind of have to go all the way through the flowering season. Long story short, a good seed takes roughly 30 years to create because you have to go through all these different flowering sessions and pick the best cultivar and then get the seed from that and kind of work your way through. So a good seed is 30 plus years.
Wow. Yeah. Dr. Calvin Lamborn is a legend in the farming world. And I love growing snap peas with my kids because they grow quickly. And obviously there's nothing like picking a snap pea right off of the vine. But when I grow them at home, they tend to kind of crap out after one like big spurt. What's the secret to letting them grow super, super strong and healthy?
I think the most important part is you got to grow them at the right time of year. They are a finicky little guy. You can't be too cold. It can't be too hot. You can't overwater them. The roots rot. You kind of have to get that perfect right there in the middle. So it is a gamble to plant sugar snap peas early. Like I said, that's a really finicky crop. If it frosts too bad, they drop their flower, or the meristem, which is the growing point, dies. The actual pod can get cracked. And then it looks super ugly, and there's all these different like things to make sure that, you know, they don't look perfect. Luckily, the thing about two peas in a pod is we don't really go for looks, we go for flavor. We are on the Central Coast, and we have kind of the perfect weather to grow sugar snap peas. We've had them on the table for the past 2 months, and to be honest, it was a pretty big gamble. We haven't had a giant frost that killed them, but we had a few frosts that made them look a little uglier than they should be. The good part about that is the flavor is still there. Fortunately, it didn't lose any big crops, but we had a lot of troubles, like 80-mile-per-hour winds that snapped all the tea stakes, that we had to go out there the next day in the pouring rain and have four guys lift up the entire row because it was super heavy, weighted down with peas. And we fixed it all, but like I said, we started early just to kind of get our foot in the door. And from now on, they'll start looking a little cleaner and tasting just as good as they have been.
Wow. Well, it's always so interesting to hear the behind the scenes of what it takes to get these crops to market. That was Zach Nichols of Two Peas in a Pod. Along with his mom, Lori, they grow many pods, including snap peas, but also a ton of interesting beans that you can check out at the Wednesday Santa Monica and Sunday Hollywood Farmers Market. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Elena Shatkin, and to our engineers, Hope Brush, Nick Lamponi, Phil Richards, and Sue Margulies. And a special thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman. As we get ready for this year's pie contest, I can't help but dream about what pies I would enter. I'd definitely enter a double crust apple, and maybe my chocolate pecan espresso pie too. I can't wait to see what all you bakers come up with this year. Once again, Pie Fest is Sunday, April 28th on the Royce Quad at UCLA. Mark your calendar and register those pies. I'll meet you back here next week for another episode of Good Food.